And I thank you all for the opportunity. That is as meaningful an introduction, as beautiful an introduction as anybody could ever get. And as I think Rabbi Yudin was alluding to, it's probably more important than anything else I have to say. At least the first part of the introduction, and that looking back and those reflections about the type of relationships that can be formed in programs just like this one, and how long those relationships can last, and how they can impact on each other, all sides of that relationship, that's 100% true. I don't think it was because of any special effort on my part. I know for a fact it was because of the good fortune that I had to have a group of guys that I was learning with those summers in NCSY Kollel more than 20 years ago that were willing to give a chance to a program like the one that we were beginning right around the same time that McClellan was starting, and I'll get to that in a minute. But to have a group of people that were willing to grow and were excited to be part of something special, and that applies not just to Memory Lane and to Rabbi Yudin and myself, but it applies to every single person in this room. And I might get a little bit distracted looking out and having another chance to learn with Rabbi Yudin and remembering those times, you will forgive me if I do. But if I do get distracted and the rest of my message gets a little bit garbled and a little bit confused, just remember what it means to have a madras and a madrasah, to have a relationship with peers and with friends, all of the different people that you can learn from, and how critical that is to the summer experiences we're all sharing. And really, that introduction took from my introduction a little bit. This is an incredibly exciting evening for me. I'm looking forward, really, for the chance to be for a couple of minutes with you here in this space, Magnus, for a few different reasons. First and foremost, for me personally, the opportunity to connect to the incredible leadership of this program, to be with Mrs. Yudin and Rabbi Yudin, and to share with them with their efforts throughout the year in building what you've been able to enjoy over the first couple of weeks of the summer so far, and what I know you're going to be blown away by for the rest of the summer, for the rest of your staff, and for sure for Ora and for Haley, and for all of your incredible Madras Code and the entire team that you have here, to be able to be with them and to share with them. We have the opportunity during the year to work together a little bit in anticipation of the summer, and then we kind of go our own separate ways in Beit Meir and in Beit Shemesh and Kollel and Mechlelet, and they don't always come together and work as one all the time for obvious and for good reasons. But for me, to have a chance at least a little bit to be here and to share with you, it's really, really very exciting and special. Rabbi Yudin mentioned a little bit of a homecoming for me also to be in this space, Medrash, again. You have the opportunity to enjoy this beautiful, beautiful campus. And for me, I've spent a good deal of time in a lot of very, very special moments with very, very special Talmidim. I feel at home in this space, Medrash, and I know it's a place where great things can happen and where beautiful views can inspire you, and you can pour all of that right into a base Medrash and to learn and to grow together, and that's very, very special for me, but mostly to be with Mechlelet, even beyond the incredible staff that you have and the beautiful campus that you have, just to be with all of you most of you I have not met directly and don't know personally, but to be with all of you that are doing such an incredible thing with your summer. Because you see, nobody understands, like someone who spent time on NCSY Kollel, what it means to spend time on NCSY Mechlelet, Mechlelet NCSY. What it means for you to be here long before there was a TJJ that you've given so much of your time to already and will throughout the summer. Long before there were 13 other programs or whatever the number is that were running throughout Israel. Maybe there was just one little touring program. And then there was developed the idea that what NCSY really needed and what the teenagers, the NCSYers of North America and of Israel really needed was an opportunity to spend time on a program like this, and a program that is based on the Torah and the Beis Medrash, a program that is based on the ultimate values that we can then share with the rest of the world. Some of you spent some time in the NCSY Kollel Beis Medrash last Wednesday night when we had a very special radio broadcast, and Mrs. Yudin was part of that, of course, as well. And the feedback I heard from the entire staff of Nachum Siegel and JM and the AM on the internet and in their broadcast in the New York area was so unbelievable, especially for the part that Mechlelet was able to give over and to explain and the enthusiasm. And it was a very, very special, meaningful night. I don't know what the ultimate audience was, and who knows what that's going to lead to in terms of branding or recruitment or anything else like that. It was a beautiful night, and it was an exciting night, and we really made an impact even on the staff of the radio show, and they couldn't stop talking about it and speaking about it. And I commented to the parents in a weekly email that I sent out on Friday. I commented to them that the broadcast that was going on was nothing more than the physical manifestation of something that's been going on in this base measure and in the previous homes of McClellan, in Beit Meir and in Efrat for over 20 years. We've been broadcasting from our base measure to the greater community. We've been trying to shout from the rooftops the things that we believe and the values that we have, the Torah that we're committed to, and this is McClellan and Kol HaBos, both to the highest degree, and this is why we're all so fortunate to be part of such incredible programs. We're going to go back home to our 6Y chapters, we're going to go back home to our families, to our communities, and we're going to continue the broadcast, whether 3 hours on a radio show, on a particular frequency, satellite, and internet, and however else that's going throughout the world. That was one little aspect of that, but long before Nachum Siegel showed up in our base medrash, and long before a few McClellan participants and NCSYers and Mrs. Judith came to join in that radio show, we started broadcasting out from this base medrash. Ki Mitzion Teitzei Sora, the very idea that the Torah that we learn, specifically the Torah that we learn in Eretz Yisrael, is something that we're proud about and that we're shouting from the rooftops and that we're bringing to the rest of the world and that we're bringing to the rest of NCSY. This is what makes McClellan and this is what makes Kolel so very, very, very special. And to be a part of that and to be part of the incredibly unique energy of this base medicine, of this program, is nothing short of a privilege. It's nothing short of a zechus. I was very, very intrigued by the entire six-week set of themes that we have here, and particularly by the theme that falls out this week of that. There are a number of things that people say and that people... I guess you could call them cliches almost, and that fits, but different ideas and different sentences, different sayings that people will give us that it's almost like we're trying to convince ourselves of something. We don't really always believe them or understand them in the first place. I'll give you a great summer program example. When you have an incredible experience, and you have, I just said it, the Madrash Chod on this program, I'm not knocking them, God forbid, no one should misunderstand what I'm about to say in a minute. But when you have an amazing experience on this program, I believe you're going to know it without anybody trying to explain it to you. Let's say it got dark outside since we started speaking a minute ago, but there was just a spectacular sunset, as there is almost every day, from the balconies of this building and from the dormitory. Spectacular sunset, you don't really need someone to point out to you or describe to you or tell you how great it is, or you see it and you're speechless. You see it and you internalize, you see it and you understand it. And the flip side of that is that when somebody tells you how great something is, very, very often, not all the time for sure, but when someone tells you, this is great, isn't it? They're trying to convince you of something that may not be completely true, and they're probably trying to convince themselves of something that is not completely true. If it's really great, they don't need to get your affirmation or give their stamp of approval to how great it really is. And that's an example of the type of thing that we know and we hear. Hey, this is awesome, isn't it? Well, I don't know. If it was really awesome, you probably wouldn't need to ask me. You probably wouldn't need to point it out to me. Type of thing which maybe it's supposed to be awesome. Maybe it's supposed to be great. I'm not 100% sure whether it is or it isn't. One of the specific examples of that, and this is very, very relevant to our experiences over 6 weeks, walking through Beit Shemesh, as I'll describe in a minute, and touring around the rest of Israel. Very, very often people will make the comment to you about how unbelievably cool it is that you're walking the streets of the Nevi'im, that you're walking in a forest or walking down Derech Hebron in Yerushalayim, the same place that Avraham Avinu once walked, the same place that David HaMelech fought a battle, the same place that the Ark traveled on its way back from the Philistine, just a few blocks away from here. You may be struck by, in addition to all of the marvelous, wonderful, and inspiring elements of a beautiful facility like this, you may be struck by the simple address, 21 Rehov Rashi. We're not on Main Street or Oak Street. We're not on Maple and we're not on Park Place. We're on a street that is named after Rashi. Of course, Rashi did not live in Beit Shemesh at any time, and it doesn't have the historical significance of actually being the home street of Rashi, but it's named for Rashi, and it's connected to a history. And we know that we're supposed to care about that. We know that that is supposed to be meaningful to us, and sometimes it might actually be. It's no worse than a cool piece of trivia. It's no worse than, I remember one Erev Rosh Hashanah traveling with my boys on Derech Hebron, the street that connects Hebron and Yerushalayim, on the way to Davin at the Kotel on Erev Rosh Hashanah. And it's kind of, you know the Kriyas HaTorah of the coming days, of the second day of Rosh Hashanah. You know you're going to read about the Akedah, you're going to read about that very journey on that very street, and you're actually traveling it as part of your Rosh Hashanah preparations. That's a very, very cool live in Israel type of moment, and it's something to mark in a scrap. What does it really mean, though? What difference does it make other than to know, if I tell you, let's give a little bit of NCSY Kollel references here. If I were to refer to a dormitory, an NCSY Kollel as being a dormitory, not like the ones here in Reshit, that Yehoshua once lived in, the significance of that would be that it's really, really old and the shadow probably leaks. It would not be very exciting for any, you'd want to be in a new building and on a newly paved street. What does it really matter? And what difference does it make in the first place to know that the streets that we are walking on, the heights that we are taking, the views that we are looking at, are views that have been shared in Jewish history and views that are part of our past? This very city is built on, there are two old Beit Shemeshes. You may have spent some time in one, both, or neither. Maybe you'll get a chance later on. There's an entire neighborhood right out to my right, to your left, where you have the first real neighborhoods of this immigration absorption center called Beit Shemesh. In late 1940s, 1950s, the oldest buildings of the modern city of Beit Shemesh, and it's referred to, if you get into a taxi, as Old Beit Shemesh. There's an older Beit Shemesh. Across Route 38, you could see it clear as day from the porch outside. There are even older structures where nobody lives. Ruins and type of archaeological digs, which are part of the very buildings and communities, mikvos and cisterns, and all sorts of other artifacts that they're still finding literally this morning. They're pulling up from the dirt in this area and the surrounding areas, things that existed in the time of biblical Beit Shemesh, and it's old Beit Shemesh. We're standing in a city that is built on top of places that are described in Tanakh. I respect you if you're a little bit bored by that. I guess it's a little bit interesting as a point of trivia. If you're a crazy history buff, okay, it doesn't even say it makes the Tanakh come alive. You're going to forgive me for what I'm about to say. I have been, and maybe you have too, I doubt this summer in this program, I've been to many boring, sorry for saying it, I've been to many exciting Tanakh Shiurim in any context, and I've been to many boring Tanakh Shiurim that take place outside on top of a rock that is part of the story that you're reading. It doesn't make it super interesting automatically, and it certainly doesn't make it have anything to do with you. What's the big... Well, what difference does that... If I have a great Tanakh teacher in Los Angeles, if I'm learning something in a way that's meaningful and exciting and relevant in South Florida, I don't need to be standing in Beit Shemesh, and the fact that I spent my summer in a... Hey, that's cool. I'll learn... What does it mean for us, and why does it matter in the first place? I want to share with you an extraordinarily beautiful insight on a couple of lines of the Gemara that probably most people in this room are already familiar with. I want to share with you Parnato. I want to share with you not something that's a joke or particularly funny, but I want to share with you something that is at the center of the celebration of Purim and one of the classic examples of the Benahafafu, of the turnabout, of the holiday and the episode of the Purim story. And I want us to think about it very, very carefully, and we're going to ask a couple of questions about a statement of the Gemara that I promise you, most of you are already familiar with. We know that the entire Purim story revolves around a fair amount of turnabout, of the fact that what we thought was going to happen, or what our enemies thought was going to happen, was completely and totally flipped on its head. One of the prime examples of that was the jubilation, the glee, the simcha that Haman HaRasha felt when he realized, or when he thought the case was going to be, that he was getting very, very positive signals about the future plans that he had to annihilate, God forbid, the Jewish people. The Gemara says as follows. Tana, we have learned as following. Kevon Shenafal Pur B'chodesh Adar, when he did that lottery, and the date of the lottery designated for the destruction of the Jewish people came out in the month of Adar, Samach Simcha Gedola. He was elated. He could not have come up with a happier month. So says the Gemara. Omar, he said to himself, Nafali Pur B'yerach Shemesbo Moshe. This is the famous, famous conclusion that Haman reaches. This is the month of the death of Moshe Rabbeinu. This is the month that is a bad omen for the Jewish people, a great omen for the enemies of the Jewish people. This is the month where destruction is in the cards and simcha and redemption is the furthest thing from the Jewish people's mind. This was the happiness that Haman had. Now listen very carefully. V'lo haya yodeya. But Haman was not a very, very wise man. You need to listen to every word of the next couple of words of this Gemara. V'lo haya yodeya. But Haman did not know. Shebeshiva ba'adar meis uveshiva ba'adar nola. He knew only half the story. He did not know that Moshe Rabbeinu died in Adar, but also that Moshe Rabbeinu was born in Adar. This is the statement of the Gemara. We tricked Haman. Haman thought that he had us. Haman thought that we were all finished. And he did not know that what he perceived to be a bad omen was in fact a good omen. I hope you are bothered by a few technical details in that line of the Gemara. It's a strange, strange line of the Gemara. There's a great commentator, a great rabbi named Rabbi Yonasan Aishitz. And Rabbi Yonasan Aishitz is bothered by at least three, maybe even four, different points regarding this statement. Number one, that he asks, in the ancient world, knowledge was not as random as it is today. There were no Wikipedia pages and the like. And Rabbi Yonasan Aishitz points out, this is a question you'll like the least, but it's still a good one. Listen to it carefully. It's very, very convenient, selective knowledge. He knew just enough to know that Moshe Rabbeinu died, but he did not know that Moshe Rabbeinu was... I mean, if he was already enough of a historian, already enough of an expert in our Torah, Rashi has an explanation that one is more explicit than the other in the Torah. If Haman is already an expert in Psukim and Yehoshua, as Rashi seems to describe, actually known as an Aishah, his knowledge, it just stopped right there conveniently. I guess it's possible. I could know the birthday of my great-grandfather and not know his yard site or vice versa. But it's convenient. And it's a little bit odd that he would have exactly that amount of knowledge and no other. Okay, question number one. Question number two. If Gemara and Talmudic statements are anything, they are precise. Much of the learning of Gemara that goes on in Bate Medrash and Yeshivos around the world is based on a word called a diuk. A diuk is an inference that is based on razor-sharp precision. There is not, you learn this in elementary school, about Chumash and about Mishnah and about Gemara as well. There are not wasted words, but more importantly than wasted words, there are no careless words in the Gemara. Did you catch the apparently careless words of the Gemara? The Gemara, it seems to be, and Rabbi Yonasan Aishitz says this can't be, the Gemara seems to misspeak. The Gemara tells us about the incredible turnabout that affects Haman. Haman thought, Haman knew that Moshe Rabbeinu died and was happy, but he did not know, what should it have said? He did not know, simply, that Moshe Rabbeinu was born. Does not say that. It says, he did not know, I'll read it to you again, he didn't know that Moshe Rabbeinu died and that Moshe Rabbeinu was, what, it's not true. You just told me a second ago that he knew full well that Moshe Rabbeinu died. Those are three words, v'lo haya yodea, so far so good. He did not know, that's not true. He did know that Moshe Rabbeinu died, and that was the entire point. Why is the Gemara imprecise, maybe too generous? It's not imprecise, it seems to be flat out incorrect.
and completely unnecessary, to say the least. Why does the Gemara say something which is imprecise at best and incorrect at worst? And finally, not a technical point, something more fundamental to the entire idea that the Gemara is suggesting. The Gemara seems to suggest that he caught Haman in this terrible mistake. He knew that Moshe Rabbeinu was died then. He didn't know that Moshe Rabbeinu was born. Ask him, Jonas and Ayashitz, who cares? Why does that help anything? Moshe Rabbeinu's death makes it a very, very bad time. The fact that he happened to be born in Adar, I mean, the last event and the more tragic event would seem to overshadow the first event. Is that going to be a happy day on the calendar? If something incredibly happy happened on April 13th, and then years later, to the same person, under similar social context, something horrible happens to that person on April 13th. Are we going to remember the prior great event and let that kind of overshadow the last event that happened? And the last event, frankly, in this case, is the one that lingers. I'm already alluding to the answer, but it's the one that lingers, is it not? Is it not true that Moshe Rabbeinu's death, in fact, was the bad omen that it seemed to be? So there are those who explain that it had nothing to do with the birth and nothing to do with the death. It was the fact that it was the same day, that it was being stressed. That is a popular explanation. But it's not the explanation that Rav Yonos and Aisha suggest. I want you to listen to me so carefully, because you're going to hear an idea that is so beautiful and so meaningful, not just for the summers that we're experiencing together right here in Israel right now, but really meaningful for a way in which we interact with a whole set of people around us and the way in which we define ourselves in a very meaningful way. Rav Yonos and I should suggest that based on these questions and a couple of others that we don't have time for right now, that the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu that is referred to in this Gemara is not the biological birth of Moshe Rabbeinu in Egypt years before to parents named Yocheved and Aaron. That is not the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu that we are referring to. What we are referring to the fact, and what Haman's critical mistake was, and the mistake of every enemy who has risen up against the Jewish people the whole door to door since then, was to believe that there is ultimate finality in death. To believe that when somebody passes away, their story ends and that there is nothing to continue. I share with you this incredible insight. Rav Yonos and Aishah says that the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu that is referred to in this Gemara is not the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu that we think of as a baby. It's not the resurrection of Moshe Rabbeinu borrowed from a different religion. It is the birth, these are his words, they are so beautiful and so insightful. It is the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu inside the heart of his Talmud Yehoshua, and the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu in all the Jewish people when Moshe Rabbeinu is no longer with them. Moshe Rabbeinu died on Zion Adar, and Moshe Rabbeinu was born on Zion Adar. Yes, biologically 120 years earlier, but also, not symbolically, in a very real and genuine way, the day that Moshe Rabbeinu's physical body left this world is the day that Moshe Rabbeinu's impact and Moshe Rabbeinu's existence and Moshe Rabbeinu's teaching and what Moshe Rabbeinu was lived inside the Torah that we learn, inside the Talmidim, starting with Yehoshua, that he was so close with. Moshe Rabbeinu was born in that very way and in that meaningful way. Our spiritual legacy, our spiritual heritage is such that we live and we define ourselves never in the here and now, never only in the events that take place to us on a daily basis, but what we are is an amazing combination of what came before us and of what we anticipate for the future. We are what came before us. We are a living embodiment not only of our own dreams and our own ambitions, but of ancestors, you know, memories of ancestors, and I don't mean active memories, I mean even knowing their names. The most historically inclined person in this room probably can't go back past their great-grandparents, certainly not past their great-great-grandparents. I don't know very much about, maybe I know where I came from in Europe or in Yemen. Maybe I know because of somebody who's named after somebody. I can make a guess based on my grandfather's name. Most of us know very little about even 3, 4, and certainly 5 generations ago. We just don't know anything about them. You could go to a special museum. You could plug your name into a special website. Maybe you could get a name. Maybe you could get a long combination of letters in Polish, you know, that have to do with some town you've never heard of and likely never visit. Maybe you'll be fortunate enough to go on a heritage trip or a march of the living and see where your great-grandparents are. Most of us won't even do that. And yet, what Rav Jonas and I just suggested is that the experiences that we are having today, the people that we are when we look in the mirror, when we wake up in the morning and we ask ourselves the question of who am I, we are them. Moshe Rabbeinu died and Moshe Rabbeinu was born. I had a roommate. I went to yeshiva called Kerem Yavne, not terribly far from here, for the 2 years that I learned after high school. That's a Hesed yeshiva made up of American students and Israeli students as well. Every room in the dormitory was 2 and 2. 2 Americans, 2 Israelis. Sometimes they got along, sometimes they fought, sometimes they, whatever it was, different relationship. My second year in Kerem Yavne, I had a very, very wonderful roommate. It was actually 3 Americans and Israeli. One of those Americans was Rabbi Levi Greenspan. Maybe you'll hear from him later on in the summer. We had a great time in that room. And you heard from him already, I don't know. Coming tomorrow. Okay, there's a great introduction. Best roommate I ever had. He's a phenomenal individual. He had his full sight at the time. He was a phenomenal individual and quite an inspiration, even before he suffered from any sort of vision impairment or disability. He was one of the roommates. And we had an Israeli roommate. One guy was stuck with 3 Americans. Just a wonderful guy. He was quiet, he was humble, great roommate in order to be able to have. We packed these giant suitcases with all sorts of American products, clothing, and appliances, and food. He had like 1 shirt and 1 pair of pants. He gave us all his closet and, you know, never asked for anything. It was a great, great arrangement. He had a big impact on us. He was a mentor and he learned. He was a wonderful, wonderful guy. He was older than us. He was 2 or 3 years older than us. He had finished his first tour. At the time, there were 2 tours in Hezder of the army. He was between the first and the second. And he started disappearing at nights after a little while, sometime late in the year. He was a Shandala guy, 4 years out of high school. And he was around less and less at night. Put 2 and 2 together. He was dating very seriously. And one day he came back and told us he was engaged. Great. It was a big simcha. So Miles was a drop on the young side. And things were happening very quick. Asked him when he was getting married. He gave us a date. Came in a few weeks later and said, that date I told you was wrong. We have a new date. And the date was a couple of months earlier. His mother was very, very, very ill. It was a situation where he had been starting to date, he decided he wanted to date, and then he got engaged, he decided he needed to get married. They tried to move the date up, 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 and up. They were unsuccessful. They actually moved the date a second time, and that didn't work either. The mother's health deteriorated, and she passed away before this final date. She passed away 7 or 8 days before the date of the wedding. It was a very, very bizarre wedding. He had just gotten up from Shiva. This chassan, his name was Natan. Natan was given a heter to shave right after Shiva. His fathers and brothers not only were not given a heter to shave, but they weren't really even allowed to attend the wedding. The father, it's an old trick in halacha, if you could call it that, the father took pictures at the wedding. The brothers served the appetizer out on the table just so that they could be in the wedding hall and participate in some level which was going on. At the same time, the Rosh Hashiva of Kerem Yavne, he was the founder of the Rosh Hashiva of Kerem Yavne. His name, Rav Chaim Yaakov Goldberg, a tremendous Talmud Chacham and inspiration to the entire Hezder movement. Rav Chaim Yaakov Goldberg himself was getting on in years and was not particularly well. He was the Messiah Kedushin at the wedding. And I will never, for as long as I live, forget sitting in that wedding hall and listening to Rav Goldberg. His voice was already cracking. He needed help getting up to the chuppah. He himself passed away just a few years later than that. And he started talking. And the first words out of his mouth were a list of Birshus, Birshus HaRabbanim, the other rabbis that were there, Birshus HaChatan, Birshus HaKala, all of the things that he's doing, and we're waiting for the speech to start. Birshus Avi HaChatan, and then he says the words, which we were kind of cringing and hoping he wouldn't say, Birshus Ein HaKala, with the permission of HaChatan, with the permission of the mother, of the chatan. And you're like, everyone's like kind of elbowing each other, and let's cut the mic, and does he even know where he is, and does he know what he's saying? And he doubles down. He says it again. Birshut Ein HaKala, with the permission of the chatan, the mother of the chatan. And he says it a third time. And there's a murmuring, and it's awkward, and here's a great man not doing all that well, and he's struggling with the speech. And just get on with it already, and say what you want to say. And all he says is, do you think I'm crazy? Do you think I don't know the terrible news? Do you think I don't know who's in front of me right now? You are wrong. And you are senile. This is what he says in his Hebrew. He's a very sharp individual. If you don't believe that she is here right now under the chuppah with us, if you don't believe that she is part of what's going on, and she's not just here in some type of hovering, spiritual, mystical type of way. She made this chuppah. She is her son. Her son is her. Not that he's no independent. Not that he's not his own person. Not that you are exactly like your parents or anything like that at all. But there is a part of her that is eternal, and that is the part of her that is inside of you. And the Rosh Yeshiva finished with nothing else to say. That's the message he wanted to give over. That's exactly what he wanted to explain. A couple of years later than that, I was in a shiva house. It was the shiva house of one of your Majikha's grandfather for his father, sitting shiva in Harnof. And he was distraught, sitting shiva, of course, and he was leafing through old papers of his father. And another personality from Yeshiva Karim Yavnev, the great Mashkiach alive today, Rav Avram Rivlin, he happened to be in the room also. He happened to be there with everybody, and he was there. It was a crowd of people, and one of the people sitting shiva, this gentleman, he was leafing through the papers, and he found one of his father's old papers that gave him pause, made him a little bit emotional. He was choked up. People asked him, "What are you looking at?" And he showed him that in the collection of documents that his father had, there was an old thank you note that was written by the deceased individual's grandson, this guy sitting shiva, his son, and it was written right after the bar mitzvah. This young man happened to be in the same chabura with Rabbi Yudin and the rest of us there that summer. And after his bar mitzvah, he wrote a thank you note to his grandfather for the gift that he had gotten, whatever it was. And he said, the highlight of my bar mitzvah was dancing with you at my bar mitzvah. I can't wait to dance with you at my wedding. 13-year-old boy, he writes that. And he was not married at the time. He was just starting, entering into the world of dating. And this gentleman, sitting shiva, he looks down on it and he gets emotional. Yet another promise unfulfilled. Yet another type of wish. The world's a tough place sometimes. A wish that will never be granted, a grandson to his grandfather, I can't wait to dance with you at the wedding. And this Rivlin takes in what's happening, and he says in the firmest and clearest way, he points a finger at the guy sitting shiva, and he says, tell me, before your father passed away, this past week, these past months, how was he doing? It's like an inappropriate question to ask in a shiva out. But he's very, very adamant. He's pointing a finger at him. How is he doing? Sick. How is he doing? How well was he? He really wasn't that well. How was he dancing? How was he moving his feet? How was he on the dance? He wasn't good on a dance floor at all. He was feeble and he was old and he was sick at the end. And the Rivlin smiled at him and he said to him, before he passed away, b'shiva ba'adar meis Moshe Rabbein, before he passed away, he had no chance, barring a medical miracle, of dancing with your son at his wedding. But now, he will be there, b'shiva ba'adar nola. On the day he died is the day he is born. And his legacy and his impact, if you don't think, if you remember the words of the Rosh Yeshiva, if you don't think, you're the one who's seen on it, if you don't think that he will be there at that wedding, dancing with your grandson in a way he never would have been able to dance with him before. You know how deep this goes? Do you know how important an idea this is? I want to share with you something. It's why we have this whiteboard behind me. I want to share with you something from Rabbi David Foreman, one of the great teachers of Tanakh in modern times. Rabbi Foreman has an extraordinarily simple insight that is not completely his own, but he develops it in a very exciting and kind of cool way. You're probably aware of the fact, I'm sure you're aware of the fact, that there are many names for God. We call God a lot of different things. Some that we can pronounce and some that we don't. Some that we sort of say and others that, okay. One of the main names of God that we have is the name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, or Yud, a hey, a Vav, and another head. And one of the oldest traditions that we have regarding the names of God is that Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, that name of God, one of the more popular and famous names of God, the Yud, the Hey, the Vav, and the Hey, is a combination of the Hebrew words Hoya, Hoveh, V'yeh. The Hebrew words of what was, what is, and what will be. And this is a wonderful description of the names of God. God was, God is, and God will be. God is ancient, and God is eternal. God was around from the beginning and will be around forever. And that's exactly the way that most of us interpret that concept of Hoya, Hoveh, V'yeh. Listen carefully, ladies, this will blow your mind. Hoya, Hoveh, V'yeh means it's been around forever. You go back to that rock that Yoshua sat on. This rock has been around for a long time. It was, it is, and it will be. This rock isn't going anywhere. This tree, this view, this forest, whatever it's going to be. And like all of those things, God is really, really old. And God will be around for a really, really long time. And Rabbi Foreman explains that is not the extent of what we are saying when we say, Hoya Hoveh V'yeh. What does Hoya Hoveh V'yeh equal Yud Kei Vav Kei? A Yud, a Hey, a Vav, and a Hey. How does that work out like that? That Hoya, I mean, you could have come up, take those letters, could have called God Harrow, you know, could have come close to a similar, could have been a whole lot of things. Hoya, a million different things. How do we end up from Hoya Hoveh V'yeh to just those things exactly? So Rabbi Foreman explained, look at it very carefully. If you start, and we'll do it very carefully and spread it out a little bit, but if you start with a hey, a yud, and a hey, the word hayah, what was, and then you want to add to that, layer on top of it, the fact that God not only is what was, but God is what is. Are you right? Hoveh. On top of the yud, the vav, and the hey. And then, if you want to superimpose upon that the fact that God, in fact, will be for a long time, and in front of it, a yud, another hey, another yud, and another hey. So, in fact, yud, kei, vav, kei, the yud, the hey, the vav, and the hey, is not that God was, he is, and he will be. It's something else entirely. It's that God, at the very same time, was, is, and will be. What God is at any given moment is all of history and all of the future. That God himself is not defined by a particular point in time, but that God is simultaneously. He's not an old rock. He's not a mountain that will be standing, that will exist in 50 or 50,000 years. He is right now everything that was, and he is right now everything that will be. And while that is a unique attribute of what it means to be God, while that is the definition of a transcendent way of what it means to be a super deity, not a human being, there is a little piece of that, just like there is a little piece of godliness in all of us. What we are is our history. What we are is our future. We are right now when we are great. All of those things in this very real moment. We daven for a great number of things in our Shemona Esrei. We daven for health and we daven for Parnassah. We daven for wisdom. The very first thing we declare when we daven, the very first bracha of the 19 that make up Shemona Esrei, is the bracha of Magen Avraham, Shield of Abraham. It's very, very Marvel comic. It's very, very superhero. Shield of Abraham. What are we talking? What is that? We're supposed to be excited about. So Shalom is later on that there should be peace in the land, that the army should be good. Is that what it is? Shield of Abraham? What's a shield of Abraham? What's a Magen Avraham? What are we even davening for in the first place? And the simplest explanation of Magen Avraham is that we pray to the God who protects inside of us the legacy of Avraham Avinu. It's not the representation of Avraham Avinu. It's not the history of Avraham Avinu. It is the fact that when we look at what defines us, there is a part of us that is Avraham Avinu's own DNA. And that part doesn't always shine through. That part we're not always focused on. That part we're not always thinking about. Magen Avraham means the God who protects inside of us, in the tiniest of boxes, iron reinforced steel, protecting the fact that whatever we do, whatever happens to us, there is a part of history, a part of our ancestors, a part of Avraham Avinu that lives inside of us. We are never defined by the limited things we see in front of us or experience at any given moment. We're defined by something so much more. A number of years ago, I may have shared this a couple of years ago in Mechlele, a number of years ago on one of the last Shabbases of the summer, so we decided that we had an amazing group of guys, many of whom had interesting stories and experiences. I think that particular summer, one of the Machachim was one of the Maccabees who had sung in the White House, and another guy who had a particular challenge in his life that he had overcome, an amazing story to tell. And we had almost like a show and tell, like just people sharing, program, people sharing the most incredible experiences that they had gone through. Almost like a throw-in or filler, we wanted to give some airtime, so before my boys were on the program, we wanted to give some airtime to the regular Bergen County or Five Towns or Detroit, Michigan, NCSYers, the guys who had grown up in those places and who had made Aliyah. We didn't have very high expectations. We thought compared to the White House guy and compared to the overcoming disability, we thought that sort of be a little bit bland, but we asked the guy who happens to live in this neighborhood, we asked him to speak about his experiences. To this day, it was such an honor. It was one of the most remarkable. He spoke for a grand total of 3 minutes. I'm going to condense it to 60 seconds. It was one of the most remarkable ideas I've ever heard in my life. 3 minutes from an NCSYer just sitting there who had made Aliyah. He said, I was in 8th grade, happened to go to YNJ, Bergen County. I was an 8th grader at YNJ. My biggest dream in life was to play high school basketball in MTA, to have a normal high school life. That's all I wanted to do. That's all I cared about. Worst day in my life in 8th grade, my parents came to me and said, guess what, we're going to make Aliyah. I said, guess what, we're not. That is a nightmare scenario, nightmare situation I want no part of. I fought and I screamed, I had tantrums, I said it was going to be terrible, I didn't want to do it, but we did it. And I was miserable, and I was dreading it. And then he says the following, this is where it gets interesting. Then he says, what I really dreaded though, I was willing to give up on MTA basketball. I was willing to give up even on my friends, some of the social things that were going on. But I knew my family, see, we were like big time religious Zionists. And I knew that the announcement that we were making Aliyah was the beginning of a clock ticking, that I was going to join the Israeli army. There was nothing idealistic in my mind about that. All there was fear. All there was, this is a 10th grader talking about his experiences only 24 months earlier. All there was fear. All there was fear that in a few short years, I am going to go to risk my life, I am going to go into the Israeli army. It kept me up at night. It defined all of my choices, what I studied in high school, who I hung out with. It was looming large. I couldn't think of anything else. It bothered me. And he says, today, a few short years later, 2 years later, I am so incredibly proud to be living in Israel. And I am so incredibly proud to have the opportunity. He just finished his tour of duty, actually, in his head to yeshiva. I am so incredibly proud to have the opportunity to go to the army. And I want to tell you what changed. Growing up in America, growing up as an eighth grader, my existence was defined by me and who I was. When I came to Israel, I recognized that who I am, what defines me, is more than my limited experiences and my limited perspective. I am a member of the Jewish people. Who I am is defined by something greater. Our rabbis teach us, as I'll tell us, in Sibur Mace, the Jewish people do not die. We are eternal. Haman HaRasha did not know that that was the day that Moshe Rabbeinu died, but also the very day that Moshe Rabbeinu lived. I am, he said, I'm no longer afraid because I'm immortal. Not immortal that nothing bad could ever happen to me. I'm immortal because every piece of Torah that I've ever learned in my life, every friend I've ever made, every relationship I've ever had, every good deed I've ever done, has eternal significance and value. I may not be able to live out, that may not be God's plan for me, to live out every dream. I may not play NBA basketball, and I may suffer things much worse than that. But I, as part of a greater whole, as part of a greater community, I am defined not by my own limited experiences, but by something greater than that. That's the gift my parents gave me when we made Aliyah and we became part of something greater and became defined ourselves by something broader and by something that says who I am is not my bedroom and it's not my camp experience. Who I am is all the things that came before me and all the things that I'm dreaming about doing and all the things that are around me that I choose to connect to and identify myself with. About 10 years ago, just over 10 years ago now, 10 years, this is the summer anniversary, 10-year anniversary of the Gush Katif. No, 11 years. Last summer was the 10-year, correct. This is the 11th year of what were incredibly dramatic moments for NCSY summer programs, but of course on a much deeper level, for the nation of Israel and specifically for the beautiful and wonderful communities that were inside of Gush Katif. And when those events were taking place, there were all sorts of bizarre subplots and subtexts that were going on. One of those subplots gave birth to a story that may very well be apocryphal. I can't swear to you that it's true, but I can swear to you that the lesson of it and the idea of it was very real then and very true and relevant to what we are speaking about tonight. At the time, there was a tremendous amount of almost messianic belief that was going on in the communities of Gush Katif. This expulsion, Jew against Jew, tearing down the communities that were built after the rebirth of the State of Israel, it will never happen. We're going to Davin, we're going to march, we're going to get together, and somehow, someway, there will be a miracle. That belief was tested. These were normal people in normal homes and normal communities living normal lives. That belief was tested in some very strange ways. Do you register your kids for school, for a school that everybody in the world believes is not going to exist? Do you pay the gardener for landscaping work that is never going to happen? What if you were in the middle? How many amongst the thousands of people who are living in Gush Katif, how many of them were doing construction work on their house? Answer, a lot of them. Do you continue to build a home on July 20th of the year of expulsion when the logical side of you knows that in 2 weeks you're leaving your home and it's going to be given over to God knows who and God knows where? And as a community, with an incredible amount of emunah and fervor, many people made the decision, every single thing we do will be with the belief and the confidence that we are not going anywhere. Reporters ate this up. The naivety of these Jewish settlers who were building houses in places that were about to be given over, who were registering for schools and putting together programs and flyers for concerts that we know never took place. They loved it. It was like lead story and half the news reports. And a news team is walking around, and there's a guy, an older gentleman, who's living in Gush Katif, and he's in his front yard. And he's known to these reporters as a more rational, stable type of fellow. He's not fervently religious, and he's never been known to them to be the least bit messianic. But in the day before the expulsion, he's planting a tree in his front yard. And they say to him, you too? You don't believe that they're coming tomorrow to evict you from your home? You don't believe that they're coming tomorrow to end this community? And he says to them the following. He says to them very clearly, he says, I'm not the least bit naive. I'm not sitting here without, my suitcase is packed. I have dinner reservations in Yerushalayim tomorrow. I know exactly where I'm going to be tomorrow night. There will be no 11th hour miracle. There will be no salvation that is coming. There will be no victory. I may even beat the traffic and leave tonight. I know exactly what's taking place. I'm going here. And then he says to these reporters, he says to them, and as sure as I am about where I'm going to be tonight, where I'm going to be tomorrow night, I am equally sure that my children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, one of them, some of them, at some point in our incredible future, are going to play in this front yard. And it is hot in July and August in Gush Katif. And if I can give them a little bit of shade when they do, I will. What's going to happen between? I do not know. Where I'm going tomorrow night, I'm leaving. But we're going to come back, and that's what I do today. I'm planting a tree so that my grandchildren will have shade when they come land. Because who I am is who they are going to be. And who I am is all of the struggles and all of the dreams and all of the ambitions of the things that came before me. And who I am is not a self-centered, very, very confined individual living in my own bubble of existence, defined by my own limited experiences. But who I am is part of a greater whole, past, present, and future of the entire Jewish people. So what does it mean to us that we're walking the streets of Avraham Avinu? What does it mean to us that there's an old Beit Shemesh and an older Beit Shemesh? What it means to us is that we know what Haman did not. We know that on that day that Moshe Rabbeinu died was the same day that Moshe Rabbeinu was born. And we know that the strength of everybody in this room is that what we take to every chavrusa, to every decision that we make, is the collective strength of Am Yisrael, the collective strength of our incredible past, and the collective strength of our dreams and our hopes for our future. That is what makes us strong, and that is what makes us great. That is what connects us to this land, and that is what connects us to each other. And that is the incredible, incredible opportunity, specifically this summer, in this place that we have together. I wish hatzlacha to everybody. I thank you for listening. Have a great night and a great rest of the summer.